There are a pair of possibly misattributed quotes at stake. If you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. The second is, everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. Are these statements inherently true? Is it possible to take complex and complicated topics and simplify them so anyone can understand? Is it also true that the first sign you don't fully understand something is your inability to simplify it?
Welcome to the CAP Knowledge Network podcast series, presented by Troy Graham, our U.S. National Director. This five-part series will explore Troy Graham's thoughts, views, and perspectives on fear, communication, culture, and leadership. Episode number 3. Culture. What it is, what it means, and how it's not just a noun, but also a verb.
Now, the sources of these quotes can be found in the speeches, writings, or some third-party sources of Albert Einstein, who it's often most attributed to, particularly in the meme world, Richard Feynman, Louis Zukofsky, Roger Sessions, and William of Ockham, who postulated the well-known Occam's Razor. Now, I won't debate who originally said it, but the fact that a paraphysicist, a poet, a composer and a Franciscan friar from the Middle Ages all expressed roughly the same premise and conclusion tells me there's something here worth paying attention to. What I believe when I read those quotes is that each of these people were effectively and simply communicating that no matter how complex a subject is or how much time, training, and studying is required to master it, the one indicator that you have a full understanding is not based on how dazzling you can be with your description, but how simply you can explain it to a layperson, subordinate, or stakeholder. I also believe that explaining something in simple terms should not be about dumbing down the subject, but more focused on smartening up the person you're speaking with. Any subject reduced to oversimplistic terms or designed to simply provide a neat, tidy narrative or quick answer to a big problem falls under a completely different truism. That would be, for every complex problem, there is a solution that is simple, elegant, and wrong. Where does that leave us in our goal of defining and then instituting the concept of culture? Well, that's probably the first idea we need to debunk. Creating a culture, or some variant on the phrase, is often listed as a core value or taken on as an initiative or set of goals by many, many organizations. This is because there is a long-held assumption that culture exists in a binary state. It either is present or it is absent, when in fact, any sizable group of people living or working together will inevitably, predictably, and unavoidably create a culture. If we look at a simple and straightforward definition of culture, it would be the social behavior and norms found in human societies. It goes on to say, as well as the knowledge, beliefs, arts, laws, customs, capabilities, and habits of the individuals in these groups, acquired through the learning process of enculturation and socialization. There it is. Denying or ignoring that a present culture exists by assuming that it is absent only makes the job of changing, redirecting, or adapting to a new culture all the more difficult. Think of it as deciding to build a house on a lot that already has a house on it. That's what leadership decision makers do on a consistent basis. It's also why the idea of building a culture continues to boggle, bog down, and bottleneck countless organizations, to the point that a fair portion of these businesses, groups, and organizations abandon the idea of cultural focus altogether. They opt for the sugar rush of short-term decisions to create short-term gains, which will then create a culture of its own. So the point we should agree on before we move any further is that culture is an inevitability, and that is produced by a process known as enculturation, where the people in the group learn the group's culture through experience, observation, as well as through instruction. They also learn the cultural norms by means of socialization. Now, anyone who attended an American high school understands the impact socialization has on cultural norms. These are forming what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior. This means we must start by determining what does the current culture look like, what works, and what needs to be changed. Sometimes we can view culture and cultural change as a goal all unto itself. We must stay focused on the only reason to change culture is to change our results. It's the furthest point to the left of the equal sign. The reality is our current culture is perfectly designed to get our current results. If we're happy with the results, our job should be to strengthen and reinforce the current culture against what can damage and even destroy it. We'll be addressing that in another podcast. But if we look at the results and they aren't what we like, then we need to determine why. To better help us determine what our current culture is, let's take a look at some examples and see if we can match any of those to what we find in our current cultural state. Let's look at the first example. In 1982, authors Deal and Kennedy wrote and published Corporate Cultures, The Rites and Rituals of Corporate Life. In this book, they identified four cultural models, each based on the speed of feedback. The first, work hard, play hard culture. This has rapid feedback and reward and low risk. Stress comes from the quantity of work rather than uncertainty. It's high-speed action leading to high-speed recreation. Examples: restaurants, software companies, and big mega dealers with lots of traffic and lots of leads. The force of the dealership itself compels actions and results. The second, tough guy, macho culture. This also has rapid feedback and reward, but it comes with high risk. In this culture, stress comes from high risk and the potential for loss or gain of reward. It focuses on the present rather than the long-term future. Examples: police, surgeons, sports. Often seen in mid-level dealerships or dealer groups, where management consists of promoted high performers. Number three, process culture. This has slow feedback and reward, and also has low risk. It's resulting in the following: low stress, plodding work, comfort, and security. Stress comes from internal politics and the stupidity of the system. It has developed bureaucracies and other ways of maintaining the status quo. Focuses on security of the past and of the future. Examples: banks, insurance companies, and large public groups with lots of layers. Number 4, bet the company culture. This has slow feedback and reward and comes with high risk. Stress comes from high risk and the delay before knowing if actions have paid off. The long view is taken, but then much work is put into making sure things happen as planned. Examples: aircraft manufacturers, oil companies. These would also be the disruptors and the speculators in our industry. The authors determined that culture was defined based on the speed of feedback, the level of risk, and the source of stress. In these models, making a change in culture is accomplished by focusing on and making changes to those three areas. And that by focusing on the behaviors of the group, you could reorient, redirect, and change the culture of an organization. These systems have difficulty with change because they have a low tolerance for adaptation and quite often experience deep J curves during the transition phase, often leading to the business group organization abandoning the culture change. We also have Hofstede's cultural dimensions theory developed in the mid to late 1980s. He and his team determined there were 6 sets of organizational cultural practices, alternatives, and combinations. The first, process orientation versus results orientation. Result-oriented cultures focus more on the now, while process-oriented focuses more on the future. The second, employee-oriented versus job-oriented. Task orientation relates to concern for production. It is the quality of a manager who maintains strong discipline to task completion and deadlines. Employee orientation, concern for people, is a trait of a manager who cares about the people who work for him, for the long-term motivation and the belief that employees generally want to know their leader cares about them as people. In extreme cases, these can either result in an authoritarian culture or anarchy. The third, parochial versus professional. Members of parochial culture feel the organization's norm cover their behavior on the job as well as at home, while members of professional cultures consider their private lives their own business. Number 4, open system versus closed system. In my opinion, these are the two binaries for any organizational culture, and all other types are just subsets of these two systems. Being part of a closed culture can at times feel a bit cultish. It feels that way because a closed culture does in fact have many of the characteristics of a cult. People are stifled, input and feedback are squelched, possibilities are suffocated. There is a belief that there is no better way. Change is not tolerated, and transformation is not welcomed. An open system is quite the opposite. This type of culture is alive and transformational. There is a belief that individuals can improve. Transformation is embraced and encouraged. Not only are new ideas welcomed, but new people are welcomed, bringing with them a new perspective and therefore opening up new possibilities. Discussions are lively. When everyone contributes, it cultivates interdependence. Because people are inspired to develop their potential, the team flourishes and the organization prospers. I'll contend an open culture requires boundaries. But instead of rule keepers enforcing a set of legal restrictions, people are guided by boundaries, which value human beings, respect the process, and foster a productive community. Because an open culture is fluid, it can appear a bit messy or even disorganized. It requires leaders who will step into their role of shaping the environment by speaking the kind truth and serving the team. Leaders need to learn and recognize the difference between these two types of culture and decide to build the healthier of the two, even if it means some short-term but temporary drops in production. Number 5, loose control versus tight control. Again, in my opinion, just a variation on the last one. Number 6, pragmatic versus normative. Another way to look at this is long-term outlook, we'll call that LTO, versus short-term outlook, we'll call that STO. High LTO cultures value thrift, effort, and responsibility to obligations, while low LTO cultures have strong convictions and emphasize beliefs and values. People in high LTO cultures are more likely to ask what and how than to ask why. Individuals from high LTO cultures may be more willing to compromise, although it may not be easy for an outsider to see that willingness. Individuals from a low LTO culture are less willing to compromise because it's seen as a sign of weakness. People in low LTO cultures tend to oversell themselves and their abilities, where we see high LTO cultures tend more towards humility. Again, you can see that these different models have quite a bit of commonality to them. But this last model we just talked about is wholly defined by its cultural differences in values, priorities, and beliefs. Now, as we look at the evolution of cultural definition, we come to 1991. O'Reilly, Chapman, and Caldwell took these models and presented their model for business culture. This was based specifically on which values were reinforced and which ones were discouraged. They determined there were 8 key values that, to one degree or another, composed the structure of the culture. Innovation. The level an environment supports creative thinking and advances. Supportiveness. The existence and level of strength in the core belief that the organization expresses trust in and commitment to its employees. Stability. To what extent does the organization aim to coordinate and align individual effort for the greatest levels of efficiency? When the environment is stable and certain, these cultures may help the organization be effective by providing stable and consistent levels of output. Respect for people. The degree to which the culture values respect for every member of the team. A culture of true respect is where diversity is valued, individuals feel that their contributions are recognized, and the team feels the work they complete is meaningful. Outcome orientation. This is the manner in which the organization holds employees as well as managers responsible for achievement and employs systems that reward the employee and the group. Attention to detail dictates the degree to which employees are expected to be accurate in their work. A culture that places a high value on attention to detail expects their employees to perform their work with precision. Team orientation. Companies with team-oriented cultures are collaborative and emphasize cooperation among employees. For example, Southwest Airlines facilitates a team-oriented culture by cross-training its employees so that they are capable of helping each other when needed. Aggressiveness. How much value and recognition is placed on competitiveness and outperforming competitors? By emphasizing this, they may fall short in the area of corporate social responsibility. For example, Microsoft is often identified as a company with an aggressive culture. The point we need to take away from all that should be that when we change the goals, the acceptable norms, the capabilities or habits of the individual, we change the culture. And the people who more closely match the values of the company have a greater likelihood of success. The successful members of the group will adapt and mold the new culture around what they see others doing, what they themselves are rewarded for, as well as observing and learning what they and others are reprimanded for. You could also use a set of definitions put forth by Charles Handy that was popularized by Richard Harrison in 1972, with linking organizational structure to organizational culture. This is one of my personal choices for reviewing a sales or service organization, as it seems to fit the four basic dealer group models, from single point store to nationwide multi-top rooftop consolidator. It makes for some easy starting points and recognizes some critical areas for improvement and change. The described four types of structure and culture are: power culture, concentrates power among a small group or a central figure, and its control is radiated from the center like spokes in a wheel. Power cultures need only a few rules and little bureaucracy. This is typically referred to as an entrepreneurial environment in the car business and is seen in most large, privately held groups. Role culture. Authorities are delegated within a highly defined structure. These organizations form bureaucracies where power is derived from personal position and rarely from expert power. Control is made by procedures which are highly valued, strict rules, descriptions, and authority definitions. These organizations have consistent systems and are very predictable. This type of culture is just as common in large public groups as it is in the small to mid-size private operations. Task culture. Teams are formed to solve a particular problem. Power is derived from the team with the expertise to execute the task. This culture uses a small team approach where people are highly skilled and specialized in their own area of expertise. Additionally, these cultures often feature the multiple reporting lines seen in a matrix structure. This model is present but less common in large publics and is mostly found in private groups and single point dealerships. Person culture, formed where all individuals believe themselves superior to the organization. It can become difficult for such organizations to continue to operate, since the concept of an organization suggests that a group of like-minded individuals pursue organizational goals. In my experience, this is the most likely culture to result in a divestiture and acquisition by a larger group. It is typically recognized by the presence of long-term employees who have ill-defined or absent boundaries with the owners. This is also the core issue most large auto groups encounter shortly after an acquisition, resulting in either high turnover, malicious obedience, or a siege mentality. These tactics had worked in the past, so the individuals see no reason they wouldn't work again. To enact change in these types of cultures is simply a matter of reframing, reorganizing, or reordering the current power structure and expertise. In the past 20 years, people like Robert A. Cook, Adam Grant, Stephen Maguire, Eric Flamholtz, and Simon Sinek have put forth the idea of cultural ethics, infinite game theory, empathy, and inspiration as a basis for good versus bad culture. What all of these models have in common is leadership, which is another word we plan on defining in an upcoming podcast. But for now, let's just say it's the alignment of your stated goals, your espoused values, the ideal future state you're looking to achieve, and your commitment to consistency, predictability, authenticity in daily actions, reactions, rewards, and reprimands. Leadership is not determined by a position, role, or level of authority. In an organizational culture, leadership is usually defined as the longest standing and most stable parts of the system. In a sales organization, this can just as easily be the number two salesperson as it can be the sales director or general manager. The people in an organization will naturally follow this person if not given a compelling alternative. The easiest way to define which of the previous cultures you are operating is to look at your most tenured people in each department. Form follows function, so the shape of your culture will primarily be related to its intended function or purpose as defined by the people who have been with you the longest. A simpler way of saying this is found in Steven Grunert and Todd Whitaker's book, School Culture Rewired. A culture is defined by the worst behavior that is tolerated by the leader. Now, I'm going to say that when the word leader is used in this quote, it is more about the highest authority than it is about the de facto leader, who in most cases is exhibiting the worst behavior. We've looked at many definitions of culture and tactics, techniques, and methods needed to change them. But we still have some unanswered questions, don't we? Have we defined this complex subject simply enough, but no simpler? And what exactly is the best culture? I have always found the simplest way to define the really big words is to look at their simple definitions and then where they came from. But I tend to look at the word as a verb. Nouns are people, places, and things, but verbs are actions. And that's what we're really seeking when we want to know what words like culture or leadership or accountability mean to our organizations. Not just what they are, but what they do. But more than that, it should be a transitive verb. So, culture as a transitive verb means the cultivation of living material, such as bacteria, tissues, cells, etc., in an artificial medium containing nutrients. It also means the cultivation of plants. And lastly, creating and maintaining an environment suitable for growth. And if we look back at the history of the word, we found that the word culture derives from a French term, which in turn derives from the Latin colere, which means to tend the earth and grow or cultivate in nature. There you have it. The simplest and most concise definition for culture and the key of whether or not you are building the right one, growth. Plain and simple, culture is creating an environment for something to grow in. Now, you as a leader can determine if you want to create an environment that grows leaders, cohesion, and success, or one that creates individual competitors, strife, and struggle. One or the other will happen. It is all dependent on your cultivation skills, decisions, judgments, and actions. That does it for this episode. I'm welcoming you back next time. I hope you're enjoying these podcasts and thank you for sticking around while I grow and mature on this platform. Remember, the difference is you. Grow what you want and prune what you don't.
Thank you for joining us. We depend on listeners like you to promote and grow our channels. Please be sure to like and subscribe so you never miss an episode. If you like what you heard, disagree with it, or have some input, we invite you to add your comments, reviews and ratings below. Would you like more CAP Knowledge Network? Then toddle off and spy us out on YouTube, on our CAP Knowledge Network video channel. There you will find videos, interviews, a few quick hits, along with some of our curated content. Thank you, and have a splendid day.